The Way of the Wizard. People want to know why I'm interested in wizards if I come from India. My answer is this. In India, we still believe that wizards exist. What is a wizard? Not someone who can simply perform magic, but who can cause transformation. A wizard can turn fear to joy, frustration to fulfillment. A wizard can turn the time-bound into the timeless. A wizard can carry you beyond limitations into the boundless. A wizard practices alchemy, turning base metal into gold. But alchemy really stands for turning human beings into gold, turning our base qualities of fear, ignorance, hatred, and shame into the most precious stuff there is, love and fulfillment. So a teacher who can teach you how to turn yourself into a free, loving person is by definition an alchemist. A wonderful way to approach this topic is through one of the most wondrous relationships ever recorded, that between Merlin and the boy Arthur in the Crystal Cave. In the Crystal Cave of the human heart, there has always been a wizard and always will be. You only have to enter and listen. Why do we need the wizard's way? We need it to lift us from the ordinary to the kind of significance we tend to relegate to myth, but which is actually right at hand, here and now. To be alive means winning the right to say anything you want, to be who you want to be. After Camelot fell, this sort of freedom died, and life has been suffocating ever since. The purpose of learning from a wizard is to find the wizard within, having found the inner guide to your spiritual nature, you've found yourself. The self is the ever-shining sun that may be in eclipse, but once the shadows pass, the sun is simply there in all its glory. There are a number of lessons in this tape, each told from the wizard's point of view. Listen to each one and let it sink in. You don't have to work or apply effort. After each lesson, illustrated by stories from the world of Merlin and Arthur, I will help you understand and live the lesson by applying the wizard's wisdom to your own experience. Lastly, we will go through the stages of transformation that the wizard takes his disciple through. I call these the seven steps of alchemy, which begin at birth and lead eventually to total transformation. There is a teaching, Merlin said, called the Way of the Wizard. Have you heard of it? The boy Arthur looked up from building the fire, which wasn't going well. No, I've never heard of that, Arthur said. Do you mean they do things in a different way? No, just the way we do, Merlin replied. With a flick of his finger, he lit the soggy heap of kindling, and a blaze leapt up. Merlin then opened his hands and produced some potatoes and mushrooms out of thin air. Roast these, he said. Arthur nodded matter-of-factly. He was about 10. The only person he had ever known was Merlin, and they lived alone in the Crystal Cave in the ancient forest. The old man with the flowing white beard had claimed his right to the royal baby an hour after it was born. I am the last keeper of the wizard's way, Merlin said. And perhaps you will be the last to learn it. You see, you will be leaving here soon, Merlin continued. Don't drop that potato. Of course, the boy already had. Because Merlin lived backwards in time, his warnings inevitably came too late. What do you mean, leave? Arthur asked, apprehensive. I'm sending you into the world, the wizard answered. I have kept you out all these years, teaching you something you're not to forget. Merlin paused for effect, then said, the way of the wizard. He did not speak of the wizard's way again for quite some time. One morning in June, however, Arthur woke up to find his bed covered in snow. He looked outside to see Merlin standing stock still. Before the wizard was a strange apparition, a large boulder with a gleaming sword sticking out of it. The vision began to fade, and with it the snow. The boy felt like crying, for he knew that this was Merlin's gesture of farewell and remembrance. And so it was. What happened to Arthur after he went out into the world is by now the stuff of legend. He eventually found himself in London on a snowy Christmas morning outside the cathedral where the sword in the stone had mysteriously reappeared. To the astonishment of the crowd emerging from church, he pulled the sword out and claimed his right to be king. He fought long, bitter wars, to achieve his throne, and then established Camelot. Every day he lived the secrets of the wizard's way. Eventually he died and passed into history. After Camelot fell, Arthur's world was swept away by strife and ignorance, and Merlin proved to be the last of his kind. The wizards knew timeless things. The path to their knowledge is open. It unfolds as we listen to Merlin speak. A wizard exists in all of us. The wizard sees and knows everything. The wizard is beyond opposites of light and dark, good and evil. The return of the magical can only happen with the return of innocence. The essence of the wizard is transformation. Every morning, young Arthur went down to a pool in the forest to wash. Being a typical boy, he wasn't terribly diligent in his efforts. One day, Merlin chided the boy. Arthur hung his head. "When I bend over the water," he said, "I can't see my own reflection to see where to wash." Merlin was beside himself with delight. "Having no reflection, you have no self-image. You can only be in the state of innocence." Innocence is our natural state before it becomes covered over with self-image, built up over many years. Without innocence, the ego, the I, the singular point of view, presents an extremely distorting focus. The ego sees only one's own judgments and labels. Because he has no labels for things, the wizard sees them afresh, and the world sparkles with newness. When the eye is fresh, anyone can see the wondrous qualities of the world. They unfold like petals of a rose. The petals of your own innocence never fade, and because of that, the world never fades either. After you have listened to this lesson, give yourself a moment to try and regain a touch of innocence. Forget all your emotions and feelings for a moment, because innocence, as Merlin teaches, is beyond the mind. Just listen to this list of words: heavy, light, black, white, sun, moon. Taking each in turn, let yourself experience these qualities. Did you notice that it is impossible for your mind to avoid some sensation of heavy, light, black, white, etc.? It takes your participation for these qualities to exist. If your participation is innocent, then they will exist in a fresh, new way. This experience demonstrates that innocence cannot be lost, only covered over. The secret to seeing innocently is to see from a new viewpoint, one that is not conditioned by what you expect to see. Your eye is the life giver of everything it sees. Behind every molecule of existence, there must be awareness. Otherwise, the universe would be a random swirl of inert gases. Without awareness, there is no life, but only activity. This lesson comes down to saying, see innocently, and you will give life. You will know your own innocence again when you can see the love that breathes within every iota of creation. The wizard watches the world come and go, but his soul dwells in realms of light. The scenery changes, the seer remains the same. Your body is just the place your memories call home. One day Arthur came upon Merlin standing motionless, staring into a pond. The boy asked what he was looking at. "I was watching a dragonfly," replied Merlin, "but then forgot whether I was dreaming of this dragonfly or whether it was dreaming of me." "Isn't the answer obvious?" Arthur asked. Merlin frowned. "You think your dreams exist inside your mind, but I find myself everywhere, so who knows which part of me is dreaming another part?" The wizard inside each of us could also be called the witness. It remains awake and aware, whether you're waking, dreaming, or asleep. Energy and information are basic to anything we can see, hear, or touch in the relative world. Yet in their primordial state, these ingredients are formless. It takes another force to organize the wondrous order of life: intelligence. Intelligence is the glue of the universe. The wizard knows that he is that intelligence. So it isn't necessary for the wizard to be awake to see. Seeing in its deeper sense can take place while we dream or sleep, because to see means to be awake to the universe's intelligence. The wizard's awareness unites, whereas the rational mind separates. The rational mind looks out there at a world of objects in time and space, while the wizard sees everything as part of himself. Hence Merlin's claim that he could hardly tell if he was dreaming of a dragonfly or the dragonfly was dreaming of him. The boundaries we erect to divide heaven from earth, real from unreal, are mere conveniences. Having made the boundaries, we can unmake them just as easily. Think of this tape. It is a solid object. Yet, a tape is made of plastic. Plastic is made of molecules. Molecules are made of atoms. Atoms are bundles of energy. And bundles of energy consist of 99.99999% empty space. So how solid is this tape? The world is entirely dependent upon the power of perception. Without eyes, the world would be invisible. If sight made the world visible, the wizard asks, who or what is the creator of sight? The seer behind the eye is just consciousness itself, giving birth to our senses so that they can give birth to everything around us. Why does the world exist? Because one vast consciousness wanted to write the code of life and unfold its strands across the page of time. It is no wonder that a wizard cannot tell where his own body ends and the world begins. Who am I? Is the only question worth asking, and the only one never answered. It is your destiny to play an infinity of roles, but these roles are not yourself. The spirit is non-local, but it leaves the fingerprint behind, which we call the body. A wizard does not believe himself to be a local event dreaming of a larger world. A wizard is a world dreaming of local events. Merlin disappeared from Arthur's world for many years, but then one day he suddenly reappeared, walking up to Camelot. Overjoyed to see his old master, King Arthur ordered a royal banquet in his honor. But Merlin looked at his old pupil as if he had never seen him before. The wizard said loudly, I shall offer this bag of gold dust to anyone who can tell me who this person is. And immediately a purse appeared in his hands. One by one, the members of the court ventured guesses. And one by one, they were dismissed with a curt nod from Merlin. Soon no one remained in the great hall except the wizard and the king. I am your old friend and disciple, Arthur said quietly. Merlin shook his head, and the king himself had no choice but to leave. He glanced back to see Merlin at the window. The wizard flung the gold dust into the air. Why did you do that? Arthur called out. I had to, Merlin replied. The wind told me who you are. But it didn't say anything, Arthur protested. The wizard smiled. Exactly. Wizards and their kind have often been content to remain nameless and placeless. They see themselves as citizens of the cosmos. Therefore, any localized place where they can be found is irrelevant. The wizard sees his body as a wisp of consciousness taking shape in the world. No boundaries restrict him. Yet mortals could not exist without boundaries. Their bodies define where they are. Merlin felt it was impossible to see the truth of the human body, that it is a river of awareness flowing through time, because so much weight of the past had accumulated on it. To experience this lesson, you need to forget your name for a while. Escaping name and form means finding out who you really are. The experience of being entirely free of roles is actually quite simple. When you wake up in the morning, there is an instant where you exist without thought. You're just yourself, in a simple state of awareness. Our habit is to identify with the thinking process. But in reality, you are not what you are thinking. As you listen to these words, turn your attention to the one who is listening. You immediately sense an awareness that is alert, uninvolved, yet intensely alive. You have interrupted the act of observation to catch a glimpse of the observer. This seer is the timeless factor in every time-bound experience. And this seer is you. Before you jump out of bed tomorrow, see if you can catch the fleeting hint of being before the mind starts chattering. The still, silent state is the castle whose walls no army will ever scale. Wizards don't believe in death. In the light of awareness, everything is life. There are no beginnings or endings. To the wizard, these are only mental constructs. To be most fully alive, you have to be dead to the past. Molecules dissolve and pass away, but consciousness survives the death of the matter on which it rides. Can you explain why you live backwards in time? The boy Arthur once asked. Because I choose to. It has many advantages, Merlin answered. I don't see any, Arthur persisted. Merlin took his pupil outside and ordered him to dig a trench. Arthur fell to and after some time finished, sweating and panting. Then the old wizard told him to fill it in again. Grimly, Arthur obeyed. Now, said Merlin, what did you think of that? It was pointless, Arthur blurted out. Exactly. And so is most human effort. If you lived backwards in time, you would have seen ditch digging as pointless and not begun in the first place. The legends claiming that Merlin lived backwards in time were a simplification. Living backwards in time actually meant defying the natural cycle of birth and death. One must understand time as the wizard experiences it. You mortals took your name from death, Merlin said one evening in the crystal cave. We didn't choose death, Arthur protested. It was thrust upon us. No, you are simply used to it. Throw off this worn-out habit, and you will no longer be trapped in the net of time. How does one do that? Arthur asked. Go back to the source of your habit, Merlin said. Find the flaw in your logic and pluck it out. It is all very simple. The false logic is our identification with the body. Human bodies are born, grow old, and die. We fall under the spell of mortality and have no choice but to embrace death. To break the spell requires a shift of identity from the time-bound to the timeless. This is the real meaning behind the tale that Merlin lived backwards in time. He wanted to follow time back to its roots. To the wizard, death is merely a belief. If you see the universe as a storehouse of energy, then nothing ever dies, because energy cannot be destroyed. We have to break through the emotional boundaries that we use to define dead versus alive. The fear of death is one such boundary. There is a simple exercise, however, for confronting this fear. Sit down with some paper in a quiet room. Write the sentence, I am afraid of, and finish it any way you like. Write the same sentence again and again, and let any ending that comes to mind be put on paper. You will discover many strange associations with fear. And these unexpected fears will bring emotions with them, anger, sorrow, and great relief. Let all emerge. The wizard's consciousness is a field that exists everywhere. The streams of knowledge contained in the field are eternal and flow forever. Centuries of knowledge are compressed into revelatory moments. When the ego is set aside, you have access to the totality of memory. One evening, Arthur woke up abruptly, shivering. I was having a bad dream, Arthur mumbled. I was the last person left on Earth. You are the last person on Earth, Merlin said. You are the only person on Earth, so you are the last. Arthur looked distressed. Merlin smiled. Come with me. He led Arthur out into the darkness and pointed up to the sky. How far away is that star? Merlin asked. Farther than I can measure, Arthur replied. Merlin shook his head. It is no distance at all. Beams of light flow continuously from there to here. Therefore, there is no separation between you and that star. You are both part of the same seamless field of light, Arthur protested. But I can't pluck it from the sky. Merlin shrugged. Separation is only an illusion. We are all immersed in one unending field of light, which is awareness. He yawned. Before you go back to bed, will you please hang that thing up again? Arthur looked down in surprise to see the star at his feet. The ego creates isolation. The most personal thing about you since you were born, your memories and experiences, lead to loneliness and isolation. The wizard is never isolated, however, because ego does not enter into his view of things. Setting ego aside means setting memory aside. When that is done, people are no longer isolated. The individual mind narrows our awareness down. In the wizard's world, everyone shares the same universal consciousness. We fragment the world by the personal way we view it, experience it, and remember it, creating shells of isolation that no one else can penetrate, not fully. Because it is completely relative, your viewpoint cannot be called real. Reality doesn't depend on a viewpoint. It simply is. The real is the habitat of the wizard. You have to look beyond the curtain of memory to begin to discover the true fabric of reality. Power is a double-edged sword. Ego power seeks to control and dominate. The wizard's power is the power of love. The seat of power is the inner self. The ego follows us like a dark shadow. Its power is intoxicating and addicting, but ultimately destructive. The eternal clash of power ends in unity. Just before he left Merlin's care, Arthur became very moody. He was nearly 15 and had rarely seen other people. Merlin asked him what was the matter. Arthur was hesitant. What I want to know is, well, you want to know what it is like to be in love, perhaps, Merlin ventured. Arthur nodded, relieved. The old wizard smiled and said, you've asked about a truly important thing. Come with me. Merlin led Arthur out into a clearing. In Merlin's hand, a lighted candle appeared, which he held up against the sun. Can you see whether it is lit or not? He asked. No, said Arthur. The sun had made the flame invisible. But what does that have to do with love? The boy asked. Like the candle that becomes invisible, held next to the sun, your ego will dissolve in the overwhelming force of love. The power of love is the power of purity. Love seeks out impurity in order to burn it away. There is no such thing as a loveless person. There are only people who cannot feel the force of love. As seen by the wizards, love is the air we breathe, the circulation in every cell. Compared to love, all other forms of power are feeble. The first step to achieving love as a complete, unshakable aspect of your life is to redefine love. Most of us think of love as an attraction to someone else, as a nurturing force. Although love is all these, the wizard would say that they are all partial definitions. Merlin explained, when the ego says, I love you because you're mine, it is making a statement about domination or possession, not about love. One day you will see a small light in your heart. At first it will be a spark, then a candle flame. Then the flame will devour the sun, moon, and stars. At that moment, there will be nothing but love in the cosmos, and yet all of it will still be inside your own heart. Learning to set the ego aside happens in stages. Try the following exercise. Go outside at night and consider the sky spread out with stars. The forces in the universe are immense, beyond the grasp of the mind, and yet the process that gave birth to everything was extremely delicate. What allows this is organization and intelligence, or love. Seeing this is the beginning of trust. Our deep fears tell us that if we didn't fight to survive, we would be crushed by nature's random indifference. In the light of trust, the wizard teaches that you are a privileged child of the universe, entirely safe, entirely supported, entirely loved. The wizard lives in a state of knowingness. This knowingness orchestrates its own fulfillment. The field of awareness organizes itself around our intentions. Knowledge and intention are forces. What you intend changes the field in your favor. Intentions, compressed into words, enfold magical power. The wizard does not try to solve the mystery of life. He's here to live it. After he left Merlin's tutelage, Arthur was often besieged by people who wanted to know what spells and incantations Merlin had taught him. "Merlin taught me about words," Arthur would tell them. "He said that words have power. When I was an infant, I remember Merlin saying, 'Eat.' When I was a little older, he said, 'Walk.' And if I stayed up too late, he said, 'Sleep.' As far as I can tell, I've been eating, walking, and sleeping ever since. So those must have been potent spells, don't you agree?" No one did. They went away wondering if this doltish lad Sir Ector had taken in would ever amount to anything. The power of words does not lie in their surface meaning, but in qualities hidden from view. Every word, for example, enfolds both knowledge and intent. Our whole lifetime is packaged inside us as imprints triggered by words. Mortals are wrapped in words, the way a spider wraps flies in gossamer, Merlin claimed. Only in this case, you imprison yourself in your own web. Which words will allow us to break out of old habits and limited identification? Words enfold both knowledge and intention. Therefore, framing an intention in words is the first step in making it come true. Whenever a word is backed up by intention, it enters the field of awareness as a message or request. The universe is being put on notice that you have a certain desire. Nothing more is required to make desires come true than this. Your every intention leads to some result. Yet the desires we send into the universal field are random or repetitive or obsessive, all of which is a waste of energy. Imagine that your mind is a radio transmitter bombarding the field with mixed messages. The things we want to accomplish, we also have doubts about. The person we want to turn into is also someone we aren't quite sure about. "I wish I could sweep out your brain," Merlin once grumbled to Arthur. "Those old, repetitive conflicts will not disappear until you change." The first step toward change is recognition. Recognize that you have had at least a few wishes come true. Unexpectedly, people have called on the phone just when you needed to talk to them. Help has come from unseen quarters. This happens more frequently than we realize. We just overlook results that are too subtle or don't immediately fit our goal. When you have an intention and send it into the universal awareness, you're actually talking to yourself in another form. Truly, you have three aspects: sender, receiver, and medium. This threefold state is known as unity. The second step is to learn how to fulfill your intentions. Get the ego, with all its expectations and anticipations, to step aside. Release your intention into the field of the timeless. The more expanded your awareness, the clearer will be the signal you're sending. When all these steps come together, the effortless flow toward an outcome will not be impeded or obstructed by anxieties and attachments of the fearful ego. Getting to the point that all your heartfelt wishes come true is what God wants for each person. It is our natural state as creators of our own reality. We each have a shadow self that is part of our total reality. The shadow is not here to hurt you, but to point out where you are incomplete. When the shadow is embraced, it can be healed. When it is healed, it turns into love. When you can live with all your opposite qualities, you will be living your total self as the wizard. "You never seem to feel lonely," Arthur remarked wistfully to Merlin one afternoon. "It's impossible to be lonely," Merlin replied. "I don't understand," the boy said. "As a mortal, you are a composite of many people, each fighting to occupy your body." "Yet I still feel like one person," Arthur protested. "As long as there is I and you," Merlin explained quietly, there will be a feeling of separation and isolation and loneliness. When you look closely inside yourself, you will find that there are many personalities competing for the use of your body. There are the roles you identify with: child, parent, male, female. Each of these has staked a claim inside you. And these personalities are usually in conflict. Into the secret caverns of the psyche, we shove as much doubt, shame, guilt, and fear as we can. All the inner conflicts create a shadow self. And so the shadow self is born, the repository of the negative aspects of our personalities. Ending the war inside yourself means bringing the conflict among all your personalities to an end. The shadow self can be relieved of its burden of held energies from the past and thus create a condition for inner peace. But you can't begin to resolve these inner tensions until you know what your inner personalities are made of. Personalities are always made of the same thing, some old energy attached to a memory. An incident which caused you resentment or embarrassment, for instance, will live on in your memory until the negative energy is released. Pleasant memories likewise live on, each expressing its own viewpoint. You can easily contact these held energies. Sit quietly, breathing easily and smoothly. Then recall an extremely unpleasant incident from your past. Allow yourself to experience the feelings that went along with it. Now notice your breathing. It will no longer be easy. Your breathing reflects the thinking process, and what you are experiencing are the three components we have been talking about: memory, energy, and attachment. These form the beginnings of a sub-personality. All sub-personalities want the same thing: to express themselves through you. The resulting conflict is what makes human life so full of light and shadow. The wizard, however, lives only in light. To move from the mortal state to the wizard state, all that is required is balance. There are many ways of releasing old energies. One of the most powerful is to use the breath. Lie down in a quiet room and relax. Take in a breath, then release it naturally. Take in another. And again, simply let it go and let any available emotions float up to be released. As you continue this exercise, your held energies will start to flow outward and be released. Like any other aspect of yourself, your shadow wants to express itself and become free. And the first step is to release negative energies rather than store them in hidden dungeons of the mind. The wizard is the teacher of alchemy. Alchemy is transformation. Through alchemy, you begin the quest for perfection. You are the world. When you transform yourself, the world you live in will also be transformed. The goals of the quest, heroism, hope, grace, and love, are the inheritance of the timeless. To summon a wizard's help, you must be strong in truth, not stubborn in judgment. After the boy Arthur left Merlin's woods, he lived with old Sir Ector and his son Kay. One day he was sitting, staring at a battered water pitcher made of lead, when Kay happened to come across him. "What are you doing?" Kay asked. "Alchemy," Arthur replied. Kay's eyes grew wide. "We'll be rich," he said. "Show me." Arthur nodded and began to stare at the lead pitcher. Kay waited impatiently, but 15 minutes later, the pitcher was unchanged. "I think you're a fraud," Kay said. "That pitcher's still made of lead." Arthur looked unruffled. "Well, of course, it's just a reminder. I'm the one who's trying to turn to gold. Alchemy is the art of transformation. As taught by the wizards, the secrets of alchemy exist to transform mortals from a state of suffering and ignorance to a state of enlightenment and bliss. Once you accept that you are the flow of life, not just a collection of bits of physical matter, the quest for perfection becomes a quest beyond the boundless. Boundaries can be mapped, and the visible aspect of a human being can be charted as bone, muscle, and cells. But the essence, being, and love that makes up a human being has a life of its own. Until you peel away the layers of light and shadow around your soul, Merlin told Arthur, you will never realize the clear, timeless core that lies at your center. You are your own alchemist, constantly transmuting dull, lifeless molecules into the living embodiment of yourself. This is the most creative and magical act you will ever undertake. Yet the alchemist inside is invisible, and few of us ever think to find out who he or she is. The alchemist's home isn't in time and space, but in the timeless, beyond memory. Sit for a moment and examine events in your life, further and further in the past. Go back through your childhood, your infancy, and this would be pure imagination, through your existence as a fetus in the womb. Watch the fetus shrink into a ball of transparent cells, then to two cells, then one, and finally cross over, and imagine yourself before that, without even a single cell to attach yourself to. As you cross this threshold, notice that your identity does not disappear. You remain what you really are, a viewing awareness that remains the same even though the scenery of your life constantly changes. This is yourself, in pure form, as life impulse. The reality you experience is a mirror image of your expectations. If you project the same images every day, your reality will be the same every day. When attention is perfect, it creates order and clarity out of chaos and confusion. After he became king, Arthur shared his experiences in the Crystal Cave with only one person, his wife Guinevere. Merlin insisted that my version of reality was an illusion, Arthur told his queen one night. Guinevere was puzzled. Yet we both see this room around us, she said. Let me show you something, Arthur said, and asked her to leave their chamber and not return until midnight. Guinevere complied. And when she returned, she found the room in complete darkness. Don't worry, Arthur's voice called. Walk toward me and describe what objects are around you, he said. The queen began walking toward Arthur, describing every detail of the room. Now look, Arthur said, as he lit a lamp. Guinevere was astonished to see that the room was entirely empty. I don't understand, she murmured. Everything you described was an expectation of what this room contains, not what was really there, Arthur explained. We walk around according to what we expect to see. Merlin said the wizard's world is the real world after the light comes on. The wizard has completely freed himself from the known. The ego is more comfortable with boundaries. Our minds generate the same images day after day, and the ego takes them to be real. These are only real in one state of consciousness, the waking state. In a dream, random firings of brain cells give rise to fleeting images. There is no proof that being awake is any different. Real mountains and fields and clouds have no testable reality outside the images that fire in your brain. Chance meetings, unexpected coincidences, premonitions that come true, all of these are shapes reality can take as it coaxes us out of our self-made prisons. If you could forget everything and anticipate nothing, you would automatically find yourself piercing the boundaries that shield you from the perception of a higher reality. You can get a taste of the unknown through a simple experiment. Blindfold yourself and sit down. Now ask a friend to put three foods in front of you. Take a taste of each. You will taste something new, an unexpected texture, a nuance of taste, a faint aroma that you had forgotten was there. This is the power of uncertainty. Things you think you are certain of actually have new qualities to unfold. Opening the way to uncertainty is hard for the ego to accept, yet it is the only way to pass into the wizard's world. Wizards do not grieve over loss, because the only thing that can be lost is the unreal. Lose everything, and the real will still remain. In the rubble of devastation and disaster are buried hidden treasures. When you look in the ashes, look well. As Arthur grew, he came to notice, then fear death. He and Merlin spoke of it one afternoon when he was 12. Mortals fear death because they're afraid of losing their possessions, their memories, the wizard told his pupil. But I'll tell you a secret. Nothing dies at the moment of death. Die to every moment, and you will discover the gate to unending life. In a world of change, there must be gain and loss. The cycle of birth and death becomes a matter of fear and struggle only when it becomes personal. After a lifetime of fighting to prevent loss, the ego sees dying as the ultimate defeat. To a wizard, dying means crossing over to a new kind of perception. Why do you think life and death can't coexist? The wizard admonished Arthur. Discovering a state of timeless knowing is what death opens up. If you're fortunate to make the discovery early, before dropping your body, so much the better. There is a pattern of gain and loss that runs throughout your own life. Moving from childhood to adolescence is a loss from one perspective and a gain from another. Getting married represents the loss of single life and the gain of a partner. However, the ego gets attached to certain energy forms that it doesn't want to see dissolved, a lump of money, a house, or a relationship. The ego's struggle to preserve the familiar is in opposition to life because it seeks to impose artificial life. When you can begin to see the seeds of opportunity in the ashes of disaster, then trust in the universe is beginning to grow. To the extent you know love, you become love. Love is more than an emotion. It is a force of nature, and therefore must contain truth. When you say the word love, you may catch the feeling, but the essence cannot be spoken. The purest love lies where it is least expected, in unattachment. The purest knight to serve Arthur was Galahad. Yet when the day came for him to become the champion of a lady at court, out of the purity of his love, Arthur shook his head and frowned. What do you know of love? Asked Arthur. If you are so eager to champion a lady, I will give you three to choose from. The king sent for Margaret, an old hunched scrubwoman. Would you serve her out of love, fair knight? Arthur demanded. I don't understand, my lord, Galahad murmured, embarrassed. Arthur sent the old woman away. A newborn baby girl was ushered in. Galahad shook his head. This love you speak of is a hard master, Arthur said. He sent a third time, and Arabelle, a lovely 12-year-old girl, entered. Galahad tried to control his anger. My lord, she's just a young maiden and my half-sister, he said. Arthur said kindly, I'm trying to show you something taught me by my master Merlin. He taught me another way to love. Consider the old woman, the baby, the young girl. As the forms of the feminine change, what you call love changes with it. When you say you are in love, actually an image you carry around inside has been satisfied. Love can turn to hatred if your inner image is betrayed or the reality of its subject changes, the king explained. What can be done about this? Asked Galahad. Look beyond your emotions, which will always change, and ask what lies behind the image. To us, love is a highly personal feeling. To a wizard, it is a universal force. Wizards do not see forms of love as higher or lower. That is the language of judgment. And wizards don't judge. There is only one kind of love, Merlin told Arthur. Personal love is a concentrated form of universal love. Universal love is an expanded form of personal love. You can experience both to the fullest if you allow yourself to be open. To some extent or another, we all fall in love with images. Usually, we are searching for someone to either reflect our own self-image or to repair it. Feeling incomplete in yourself, you try to bolster your lack through someone else. Searching out your own voids is the first step toward universal love. Filling them with the essence of life is the second. If you honestly look at your past, you will always find a mixed bag. Some experiences may have aroused love of self or others, many did not. These images are what they are. Accept them and move to a higher sense of self, which is unconnected with memory. This is the region of love, the region of yourself entered through meditation. You can get a sense of what it is like to go beyond images through the following exercise. Imagine a beautiful woman or handsome man in your mind's eye, someone who represents your ideal object of love. Then change their face, making it older and older, until what you behold is wizened and wrinkled. Is your feeling of love still as strong as when you first started? Can you call it love when a mere change of image causes such an alteration? Once you stop seeing love as a mere emotion, it makes sense that as a universal force, it is drawing everyone toward it. Thus, we should honor every expression of love, however distorted. Beyond waking, dreaming, and sleeping, there are infinite realms of consciousness. A wizard exists simultaneously in all times. A wizard sees infinite versions of every event. The straight lines of time are actually threads of a web extending to infinity. Merlin's robe was embroidered with moons and stars, and the boy Arthur was curious why that was so. "Let me show you," Merlin offered. He took Arthur and sat him on a hilltop. "Now tell me the furthest thing you can see." "I see the forest extending for miles until it reaches the horizon. That's as far as I can see," said Arthur. "And what is further than that?" Merlin asked. "The stars and then empty space extending to infinity." "Very good," the wizard said. "And if we were in our crystal cave," he questioned. "Well, outside it would be the forest, the horizon, the sky, sun, stars, and empty space." "Then mark well," Merlin said clearly. "No matter where you go, the same infinity extends in all directions. You are thus the center of the universe, no matter where you go. Knowing this, you would wear moons and stars too." A wizard believes in a present that is eternal. He sees that all events occur simultaneously, and every place is the same point surrounded by infinity. To make use of infinity, you must retrain your mental conception of time and space. "You mortals believe that the past creates the present and the present the future," Merlin chided the boy. "Imagine a perfect future. See yourself in that future, at this very moment." Arthur suddenly had a vision of Camelot in all its glory. "Now take the memory of that future and bring it here into the present. Shed the burden of the past and let your vision of a realized future guide you." He smiled at the boy. "You're living backwards in time, just as a wizard does, living tomorrow's dream today." "And you have changed the past then by no longer letting it influence your actions in the present?" said Arthur. "Exactly," the wizard nodded proudly. "There is truly only the eternal now, ever renewing itself. Change the past completely by seeing it as unreal, a phantom of the mind. You can seize control of your life and live the highest ideals now. Living them now is how they will be achieved. Time is an eternity extending in both directions, no matter what moment you choose as your beginning. Our linear sense of time is nature's way of letting us fulfill our desires one at a time, which is, after all, the most enjoyable way. What creates the illusion of past, present, and future is just the focus of your attention. When you can use this power consciously and suspend the linear conception of time, you will be a wizard. Seekers are never lost because spirit is always beckoning to them. Seekers are offered clues all the time from the world of the spirit. Ordinary people call these clues coincidences. To a wizard, there are no coincidences. Every event exists to expose another layer of the soul. Spirit wants to meet you. To accept its invitation, you must be undefended. When you seek, begin in your heart. The cave of the heart is the home of truth. Merlin had the strange habit of seeming to enjoy the occasional mishaps that befell the boy Arthur. If Arthur came home to the cave with cuts and bruises, or having narrowly escaped an accident, the wizard would murmur, "Good," and nod approvingly. "How can you be happy when I'm hurt?" Arthur cried one afternoon after such an exchange. "Whenever something bad happens to me, you seem pleased." "I was rejoicing at your escape," Merlin said kindly. "If you only knew it, these accidents of yours could have been much worse. You're learning to save yourself." "There are no accidents, despite what you mortals believe. Be sure that everything that befalls you, good or bad, is the result of some action in the past, however distant." The wizard shook his head. "If you look, you will see that a disguised clue to your true spirit is present in every coincidence. It is up to you to heed them and interpret them." If you see the world as material, then events happen without regard for human existence. On the other hand, if you see that spirit is the primary force in the universe, then nature's seeming indifference may be a mask or contain a hidden message. The messages remain disguised so long as our perception is clouded. Seekers are those who try to resolve the seeming paradox of God's indifference and God's love. From hurt or failure, one can seize the deepest truth. And this enigma is worth devoting one's whole lifetime to solving. Narrow escapes, lucky accidents, and intuitions that come true all can be called clues. The normal patterns of cause and effect are stretched, sometimes broken. Everyone notices unusual events, but unless you see them as clues, you won't ask what they are about. They will remain meaningless. If you're willing to accept that spirit could be beckoning to you, the clues will begin to change. Instead of being simple coincidences, clues will begin to take on spiritual overtones. The great joy of crossing into the wizard's world is that the whole world comes alive. "Respect your mystery. Nothing is more profound," Merlin said, "but pursue it ruthlessly. This is what makes life rich, that it has more to offer with each clue that it reveals." Wizards never condemned desire. It was by following their desires that they became wizards. Every desire is created by some past desire. The chain of desire never ends. It is life itself. Don't consider any desire useless or wrong. Someday each one will be fulfilled. Desires are seeds waiting for their season to sprout. From a single seed of desire, whole forests grow. Cherish every wish in your heart, however trivial it may seem. One day, these trivial wishes will lead you to God. It was a miraculous Christmas day when Arthur pulled the sword from the stone. "Where is Merlin?" the surprised young man thought, certain that the wizard had accomplished the feat with magic. But Merlin did not show his face. Late that night, Arthur sat up restless. "I need you, master," he prayed. Suddenly there was a knock at the door. But instead of the wizard, it was only Kay, his adopted brother. Disappointed, Arthur led his brother back into the room, then gasped. Three objects had appeared on Arthur's bed. A straw doll, a broken slingshot, and a cracked mirror. "This doll was my first toy," said Arthur in wonderment, picking it up. "This broken slingshot I made when I was 8. This cracked mirror I found in the woods when I was 12. They were the most important things I ever owned."
"Worthless trash," Kay muttered.
Arthur insisted. "No, no. Now I know Merlin has guided me all along. You see, Kay, when I was 2, I only wanted toys. When I was 8, I wanted only to hunt sparrows. And when I was 12, I only wanted to look in a mirror to see if girls would find me ugly or handsome. All these things I have put behind me, and yet each one was a stepping stone to this very moment. Now I see, one day so shall I put away the crown, although it is my sole wish and destiny today." Desires never end, no matter how many wishes come true. And at the same time, no single desire lasts long enough to allow us to put desire behind us. Despite condemnation in both Western and Eastern religious traditions, in a wizard's eyes, there is no reason to cast judgment against desire. Seen for what it really is, desire expresses your ultimate need to rejoin perfection, he told Arthur. There is no quicker way to God than your own wishes and needs. The problem is not with desire, but with what happens when your desires are blocked or frustrated. Then the struggle and judgment begins. Without desire, you couldn't grow. Imagine yourself as a child who never wanted to go beyond playing with toys all its life. Without new desires constantly arising inside you, you would be trapped in perpetual immaturity. We live in a society where people desire more and more material things. Yet what often lies behind affluence is a spiritual void. This is caused by turning to externals and expecting them to fulfill spiritual needs. Desire must be seen as a path. In the beginning, desires are about things like pleasure or survival or power. But in time, the path of desire leads beyond these gratifications to a desire for God. Rejoice in the desires of the moment, but be prepared for them to fall away, Merlin would tell Arthur. The problem will be holding on when the flow of life wants you to let go. No desire is trivial, because every desire has a spiritual meaning. Each is a small step leading to the day when you desire the highest fulfillment, which is to know your own divine nature. The most good you can do for the world is to become a wizard. It was the last day they would spend together. The boy Arthur stood by the side of the road, gazing back at the thick patch of woods that had grown up overnight, swallowing up Merlin's glade. He felt a pang, knowing that this loss would be felt by all mortals, not just himself. I won't be coming back, will I? He asked Merlin, who stood at his side. No need to. You're done with me. Arthur's eyes filled with tears, doubting that he'd ever be done with his friend and tutor. The wizard said, I wanted to give you a parting gift, and I could think of nothing better than this. He pointed to the road beneath their feet, which had also appeared overnight. A wizard knows that we do not own this earth. We only walk it. Home is this moment, and moments are always moving on the road of time. Arthur was silent. Merlin said, walking away from me really is the greatest gift I can bestow upon you. And with that, the boy's unwilling feet started to move. Merlin faded from his mind until only a lingering voice remained, saying, I have led you into the secret places of your soul. Now you must find them again, this time by yourself. In a moment, this voice, too, faded away. Then the boy smiled. He suddenly knew that every time he saw a road, he would think of Merlin. A free person lives in spirit, just as a wizard does, and is able to do far more good than can ever be done outside spirit. Our sense of attachment to this life begins with our relationship to this earth. Mortals believe that they own the world. As the wizard sees it, the world has a spirit that shelters us and allows us to shape our fate. But spirit can never be owned or controlled. If you want to do good for the world, be completely selfish and become a wizard, Merlin said. If you want to do good for yourself, be completely selfish and still become a wizard. You walk the earth as an individual, but you also walk it as part of the earth. Therefore, as you regain yourself, you regain the world. When you live in the moment, you touch the source of life and all its unlimited energy. At this very moment, you're a wizard. You are perfected in spirit. You have never separated from God or nature. All that has happened is that in your struggle not to feel pain, you've started to block the present moment. Trust in trust. Have faith in faith, Merlin said. That is the only solution when you have lost trust and faith. Allow yourself to stop believing that struggle is the answer. Appreciate in silence the life that is meeting you at every moment. Abundance, peace, intelligence, and creativity are the gifts of silence
wrapped inside the spirit of the earth.
In King Arthur's time, no quest elicited more passion than the search for the Holy Grail. Every one of Arthur's knights dreamed of acquiring this elusive prize, which would bring God's protection and blessing to their king. One night in early spring, Sir Percival and Sir Galahad sat beside a small fire. They had pledged to go on a holy retreat together to purify themselves for their search for the Grail. "My soul burns for the Grail, Galahad," Percival confessed. "I don't know if my heart is pure enough to gain the Grail," the younger knight admitted, "but my heart will be sore until I try." The sound of footsteps approached. The knights tensed until a faintly mocking voice said, "I need a fire, if you would be kind enough to share one." Percival called out, "Be off and build your own." "I shall do just that," the voice called. Percival jumped to his feet as the ground around them burst into flame. A tall, gaunt figure walked through the circle of flames and stood over them. "Merlin," Galahad said in wonder, "what brings you here after this long leave?"
"Not your insolent friend," Merlin replied, eyeing Percival.
He turned back to Galahad. "The Grail isn't a thing you can run after on horseback, and possessing it doesn't confer God's blessing." Percival burst out, "How can you say that?" Merlin glared at him. "My dear Claude, if all this world is God's creation, then how could any part of it be less blessed than any other?"
"But there is a Grail, isn't there?" asked Galahad.
Merlin nodded as he sat beside them. "I will be there when you find the Grail, though you will see neither me nor it." Merlin looked pleased with himself, and the knights looked dumbfounded. "I am here to guide you to the Grail," Merlin declared. "What you wish to know, I can teach. I only want to clear your heads of any misguided dreams you may have about the Grail." His voice dropped. "The quest that brings the Grail as its prize is an inner journey, a quest of transformation. When the 7 steps of alchemy are achieved, then, and only then, will you be able to summon the Grail." Galahad asked quickly, "Will you show us the 7 steps?" Merlin smiled faintly. "The first step is innocence," Merlin said quietly. "You were born into innocence. As a baby leaves its state of innocence, it emerges into a harsher world. Desires spring up that are not immediately fulfilled. Pain is experienced for the first time, but the innocence is never truly lost."
"How does one know that this innocence is really there?" asked Galahad.
"Look for the characteristics of the infant," replied the wizard. "Alertness, curiosity, a sense of wonder, security that you wanted on this earth. All babies feel these things." "The next step announces the arrival of the ego," Merlin went on. "The sense of I. To have I, you must also have you. And thus, we have the birth of duality. Every baby comes to realize that there is something other than itself, the outside world. The ego says, this is me. That is not me." Percival said thoughtfully, "It must be here that the Grail quest began. Where else but in separation?" "Yes," Merlin agreed. "In separation, you began to look for yourself in objects and events. The birth of ego gave rise to aspects you can still sense, fear of abandonment, the need for approval, possessiveness, self-pity. You became addicted to the world because you were no longer fulfilled in that simple way a baby is. But do not despair, because beneath these changes, a deeper force was at work." "Now we come to the birth of the achiever," Merlin continued. "Once you have ego, you have a world out there and an urge to go out into the world and achieve. You are moving further away from the sense of peace, unity and trust that you were born with." "A sad tale," Percival mourned. "No," Merlin replied. "The birth of the achiever gave you confidence and a sense of uniqueness. It makes this a joyous world full of things to do and learn. But as long as ego is present, the achiever will be present, and the achiever never satisfies its appetites. As the ego grows, it smothers the spirit with layers of materialism and self-image until a small voice can be heard. Where is love? Where is being? The fourth step, yet another birth, that of the giver,
is at hand. The ego finally realizes that happiness doesn't lie in just taking, but also in giving, Merlin continued. Giving connects two people, the giver and the receiver. It gives birth to an active sense of belonging to someone who has learned to create happiness. Love has entered the heart, Galahad mused. Yes, Merlin agreed. As long as the ego pursues self-interest, it doesn't feel real love. But in giving, even though the ego still dominates, it has begun to look outside itself. As time passes, individuality begins to open up and broaden its horizons, the wizard told the two enraptured knights. In time, the giver takes the next step to the seeker. One's old, familiar ego concerns are set aside. Now the person becomes eager for spiritual experiences, far surpassing even the most intense love of another person. The giver, who wanted to embrace the world, now finds that the world is not a source of fulfillment any longer. A thirst arises to see the face of God, to explore the silence of pure awareness. God may be everywhere, Merlin went on, but that does you no good if you cannot see where he is. The seeker seeks in order to see. With the birth of the seeker, we find a new, deep-felt need to escape the boundaries imposed by time and space. The appearance of physical limitation arises because this world is a school or training ground. How you see yourself, so you will see the world. You may say that you want God, but you also want to keep up these limitations. So God stays away, Galahad said mournfully, and the quest of the Grail is never ending. Spirit could not stay away from you, Merlin said kindly, because everything is spirit. As the seeker, the wizard is drawn to you. It is also the stage for which mortals find themselves least prepared. For the first time, the ego's claim to be all-knowing and all-powerful is questioned. The birth of the seeker, therefore, can be extremely turbulent. The ego gives a violent reaction. It is not going to surrender its power without a struggle. The voice of spirit announces that there is a higher reality. Ascending to that reality is another matter. How will a person know that he's a seeker? Asked Percival. Merlin smiled. Giving becomes motivated by selfless love and compassion. Intuition becomes a trustworthy guide to action, replacing strict rationality. Intimations of God and immortality appear. Addictive patterns will start to disappear. Meditation and prayer become parts of daily life. Spirit is everything, and its appearance in your life will make all things better. The sixth step, the wizard continued, the birth of the seer is just below the surface of any seeker. Once you truly ask, where is God, you will see a response. The birth of the seer spells the end of the ego, the end of all outward identification. Now self-image is seen for what it is, a flimsy projection made real by the ego's desperate need to place importance on the time-bound mind and body. Spirit is a direct experience, but it transcends this world. It is pure silence, teeming with infinite potential. All questions cease because you find yourself in the womb of reality, where everything simply is. When the eye of the seer falls on something, it is simply accepted for what it is, not judged. When you have no lack to fill, then just being here in this world, in your body, is the highest spiritual goal you can possibly attain. I long to be the seer you speak of, Galahad said fervently. Merlin nodded. Which means you are ready. For you, this world will begin to disappear as a solid thing and recede into the overwhelming light of being. He turned to Percival. And I include you in this stage too, however you imagine I judged you. Percival stammered, what will this new life be like? As always, it will feel like a new birth, Merlin answered. In place of struggle, you will experience all your desires naturally and effortlessly coming true. The seer allows others to be who they will be. They put up no obstruction to other people and events, and any small sense of I has been surrendered. It's hard to imagine that there could be any higher stage of life, Galahad said, deeply moved by Merlin's speech. Merlin shook his head. Fulfillment isn't achieved until you know God as completely as he knows himself. This state is the seventh and final step of alchemy, pure spirit, When it dawns, the seer finds that what seems to be total joy and fulfillment can still expand. You see, arriving in the presence of God is just the beginning of your quest. You began in innocence, and so shall you end. But this time, you have gained complete knowledge. When you are able to see yourself as spirit, your identification with this body and mind will cease, and the concept of birth and death will cease. You will be a cell in the body of the universe. Wizard is just another word for the seventh stage. Birth for a wizard is merely the idea that I have this body, and death is merely the idea that I no longer have this body. No amount of thinking or feeling can approximate this state or bring it to you. Your mind's internal dialogue must end and never begin again. All that will truly change is your focus of attention. In your being is every aspect of the universe, as complete and eternal as the universe itself. As Merlin spoke, the two knights felt themselves transformed. A feeling of truly belonging suffused their hearts. "We are home," Percival whispered. "In truth, this is your natural state," Merlin murmured. "This is your destiny, the end of your quest." "In the end, we shall return to the beginning," Galahad mused. "Yes," said Merlin. "Each of you begins with love, goes through struggle, passion, and suffering, only to end in love again. Spirit is the state of the miraculous, which will unfold in three stages," he explained. "First, you will experience miracles in the state called cosmic consciousness. Every material event will have a spiritual cause. Your slightest wish will cause cosmic forces to bring about its fulfillment. Second, you will perform miracles in the state called divine consciousness. This is where you fuse with God's power. The world becomes illuminated from within, and there is no doubt that matter is simply spirit made manifest. Here you will see yourself as the creator, not the created. Third, you will become the miracle in the state known as unity consciousness. Now any distinction between creator and created has vanished. Although you will seem to reside in a body, it will be only a grain of being on the shores of the infinite ocean of being that is yourself." As the knights listened, they had a vision of spheres of being opening like flower petals. As the last one opened, a nearly transparent diamond could be seen rotating in its center. "Behold the Grail," Merlin whispered. "This is the point of pure light that burns within your soul." The knights knelt and prayed fervently. "Live in devotion to this moment," said Merlin. "Now you must win the true Grail, not just its vision, the crystal speck of being in your own heart." Suddenly, Merlin yawned and stood up. He said, "From beyond the reach of time, I say that I am the one who has no need for miracles. What could be more miraculous than life itself?" Then the old one was gone. Percival and Galahad stood speechless. The spell started to fade, and they both trembled, regretting their return to Earth. When dawn arose, they made their way back to the castle. Percival saw King Arthur at his window, watching them. "Do you think we should tell of this?" Percival said. "I'm certain the king knows. It must have happened to him while he was with Merlin. Let us call this the Night of the Crystal Cave. The king will know what we mean." And although they had been in no cave, but out under the canopy of a spangled sky, Percival instantly agreed.